gotten raped, Paoli pronounced. She didn't know. She did not know. If Washburn didn't know whether she'd granted consent, Paoli demanded, how could Jordan Johnson have known whether she'd granted consent? Paoli also brought up Washburn's passivity during the alleged rape and pointed out, it's common sense to talk about the fact that she didn't scream, she didn't roll off the bed, she didn't move in any way. To discredit Washburn's account of how Johnson pinned her on the bed with his forearm across her chest, pulled off her pants, flipped her over, unzipped his own pants, and then penetrated her from behind while holding her forearms down, Paoli produced a life-sized cardboard facsimile of Washburn. This is 68 inches tall, he told the jury. That's her height. Then he laid the replica of Washburn on the courtroom floor, placed himself on top of it, and demonstrated how it would have been impossible for Johnson to do what she said he'd done, ignoring the fact that the cardboard cutout was flat, whereas both Washburn and Johnson had testified that she was kneeling, with her buttocks raised, when Johnson penetrated her. As Paoli performed this crude reenactment of the alleged rape, Cecilia Washburn and her family watched from the gallery with horror and disgust. In marked contrast to Washburn, Paoli told the jury, Jordan Johnson testified to you directly, consistently. She wants to say that he's some kind of animal that flips a switch and then does some terrible things. And that's not the truth. You all saw Jordan. He's as everyone describes him. He's quiet. He's contemplative. He does not seek the spotlight. He does not jump up on the pedestal. He played football, and we gave him the status. He didn't take it. He played football well, and we gave him the status, all of us. And that's part of the reason he's here. High profile. Celebrity. DOJ. That's why he's here. Paoli asked the jury once again to ponder Washburn's seemingly inexplicable behavior immediately after she was allegedly raped. Eating a snack, responding to the text from Brian O'Day with a smiley face emoticon, and then driving Johnson home without giving any indication that she had just been raped. This is all the stuff that they need the Boston expert to explain, Paoli said derisively, because it doesn't show this violent encounter at all. Not at all. The truth does not require an explanation. I'm sure my dad told me this one. My dad was a tire salesman. Objection, Prosecutor Susie Boylan declared. Your Honor, counsel is testifying again. Sustained, Judge Townsend agreed. I have heard that if you're explaining, you're losing, Paoli continued, unfazed by the interruption. If you're constantly having to explain, you don't have the evidence. And the chief explainer, of course, is the Boston expert. As Paoli was concluding his two-hour summation, he asked the jury a rhetorical question. Why would Jordan Johnson rape Cecilia Washburn when he knew her housemate was sitting just outside her bedroom door? Why would he even think of committing such a reckless act, given his high profile in the community, his sterling reputation, and everything he stood to lose? It doesn't add up, Paoli insisted. After David Paoli sat down, Prosecutor Joel Thompson took the dais to present the state's rebuttal statement. A long time ago, he told the jury, people figured out that if you repeat something that isn't true enough times, then people will start to believe that. Mr. Paoli comes up here, and he gave you, I submit, an extraordinarily deceptive closing argument and misrepresented many facts. Gesturing toward Cecilia Washburn's family in the gallery, Thompson noted that Paoli continues to claim that those people sitting over there with Cecilia as they sit here today doubt her story. Absolutely false. Cecilia's family, Thompson explained, reacted the same way most other families of rape victims react, with shock and disbelief and self-criticism. That's exactly what Dr. Lisak explained to you was the science, Thompson said. And what's interesting is Dr. Lisak becomes the Boston expert in Paoli's derogatory characterization. He's other than us. He's not from here, so we can't believe him. No expert in the world, Thompson testified, would have been credentialed enough to satisfy David Paoli and Kirsten Pabst. So we got an expert from Boston to come in here. The best to explain to you the truth about the science, because it is counterintuitive and it is paradoxical. And what he told you in this courtroom, ladies and gentlemen, was not his opinion. He was telling you what decades of research have shown. Lysak provided the jury with the scientific background they needed to understand the evidence, Thompson said, while Paoli and Pabst firmly staked out territory on the opposite side of scientific research. They have said, disregard what Dr. Lysak told you, because we desperately need to play on your possible ignorance and your possible misunderstanding of rape myths. That is not a way we get to the truth, ladies and gentlemen. Manipulating the evidence, misrepresenting the evidence, is not a way we get to the truth. Joel Thompson pointed out that he sometimes prosecutes homicide cases. A body speaks of how it was killed, he said. A drop of blood speaks of who left it. In similar fashion, he said, the bruises and red marks on Cecilia Washburn's body speak to whose account is true. The defense was trying to pressure the jury into believing otherwise, he argued, because the defendant's life hangs in the balance. Thompson cautioned the jury members against acquitting Jordan Johnson because they might be inclined to think, the damage is done. I don't want to ruin two lives. One is already ruined. Let's not ruin another. Such reasoning would be wrong, Thompson said, because considerations of sentencing or consequences outside of your decision about guilt or innocence are not in any way relevant to what is true. And we don't look to you as much for justice as we look to you for truth. Your only responsibility is rendering a true verdict. The harm done in this case was not done in this trial. It was done in the rape of Cecilia Washburn. To determine the truth, Thompson observed, we have to rely on the evidence. And the best evidence is that Cecilia Washburn went in that room one person on the night of February 4th, 2012, and came out a very different person. It's been suggested that maybe this was just a lie by Washburn that got out of control. Well, if that's true, it would have to have been a lie concocted within 3 to 5 minutes, because she sent that troubling text, OMG, I think I might have just gotten raped, he kept pushing and pushing, and I said no, but he wouldn't listen, less than 5 minutes after the rape allegedly occurred. So what you're finally left with, ladies and gentlemen, is two stories of what happened in that room, Thompson told the jury. According to one of these competing narratives, a young man in a relationship with another woman texts Cecilia Washburn because he wants to get laid, and he thinks she is eager to have sex with him. It's Saturday night, Thompson explains. He's had a few beers, and his buddy says to him, get her done. Cecilia Washburn, on the other hand, is tired, unshowered, sleeping, takes no time to clean herself up, dress nice, or put on makeup. Although she hoped to have sex with Johnson at some point in the future, she did not want to have intercourse with him that particular evening. He thought he was having sex that night, Thompson pronounced, but she did not. When Washburn made this explicitly clear to Johnson, he ignored her and raped her. To the defendant, it was normal. No words, no talking afterwards. He goes into the bathroom, leaves the house, and the next words he utters to her are, well, thanks, when she drops him off. He admits her text message to Stephen Green doesn't make sense. And he's right. It doesn't make sense. Nor does the emotional distress witnessed afterward by Green, Thompson added, because Washburn's reaction is inexplicable if she wasn't raped. Cecilia Washburn's version of what happened, Joel Thompson continued, involves the defendant changing, going from gentle and trusted to forceful and scary in a heartbeat. She's in a secure, safe place with a trusted person who would never harm her. But then the defendant starts using force to get what he came for. She says no, Johnson continued. She resists. She puts her knees up. She pushes him away. But Johnson was determined to have sex that night, so he raped her. And the trauma of that rape, Thompson said, was written all over her the minute she left the room. The defense attorneys, Thompson said, would have you believe that this unrebutted emotional reaction was either caused by a lack of snuggling or a realization that the man wasn't going to be her boyfriend. But Cecilia Washburn was not, in fact, a woman scorned, or hiding a pregnancy, or trying to get advantage in a child custody case, or any of the other reasons we might think someone would make a false allegation. She has no motive to endure what she and her family have endured in this last year, and what they continue to endure. She will not leave this courtroom all better. You saw it on her. You saw it on her friends and her family. Don't let yourself be confused, Thompson implored. Attorneys know that confusion is the next of kin to doubt because it feels the same way. But the confusion the defense worked so hard to create is not doubt, he said. Cecilia Washburn's only motive for reporting that Jordan Johnson raped her was to hold him accountable for what he did and to prevent him from doing it to anyone else. That, Thompson told the jury, is your motive. Chapter 28. Prosecutor Joel Thompson finished his rebuttal at 1:08 p.m. Friday afternoon, prompting Judge Karen Townsend to tell the 12 jurors to gather up their notebooks, head for the jury room, and start deliberating. As the courtroom emptied, Jordan Johnson's father leaned over the gallery railing and embraced his son. Just after 3:30, an announcement was made that a verdict had been reached, and the people milling around the courthouse hurried back to the courtroom. For a jury to arrive at a verdict in less than 2.5 hours after such a long, complex trial was highly unusual, and it took almost everyone by surprise. Because few had anticipated that the jury would finish deliberating so quickly, and most of the spectators had left the courthouse to have lunch, when Judge Townsend called the court back to order, the audience in the gallery was only about a third as large as the audience for the closing arguments. Johnson sat down at the defense counsel's table, between David Paoli and Kirsten Pabst, betraying no emotion. Neither Cecilia Washburn nor any of her family were present to hear the jury's decision. A little before 4 o'clock, the jury forewoman handed the verdict to the bailiff, who read it to the court. We, the jury, duly impaneled and sworn to try the issues in the above-entitled cause, enter the following unanimous verdict. To the charge of sexual intercourse without consent, we, the jury, all of our number, find the defendant, Jordan Todd Johnson, not guilty. Raucous cheering filled the courtroom. Johnson, Paoli, and Pabst burst into tears and embraced. The Missoulian Twitter feed erupted with commentary, almost all of it expressing support for Johnson, Paoli, and Pabst, and or berating Cecilia Washburn. Innocent. I would love for the accuser's name to be released and plastered everywhere like Jordan's was. Justice was done today on a case that never should have gone to trial. Paoli is a damn good lawyer. Justice has been served. Hopefully UM will stop getting such a bad rep now. At eGrizz fans, Jordan Johnson found not guilty. In related news, Gwen Florio now taking applications for a new scapegoat. Missoula loves you, Jordy. We've been behind you the entire time. Now sue her for every last dollar. Hashtag civil retribution. Women who falsely accuse men of rape should be thrown in prison. Glad it's over, happy he was found not guilty. Hope he comes back to play Grizz football again. A big speed bump in his life. So glad Johnson was found not guilty. That girl seemed like nothing but an attention seeker. Even if the UM apologized and offered to reinstate JJ, I don't see how he could possibly continue at the UM. Hashtag free agent. Johnson had been suspended from the University of Montana football team on July 31, 2012, and did not practice or play for the Grizzlies for the entire 2012 season. Immediately after the trial, he appealed his suspension, and on Tuesday, March 5, 2013, the university announced that he had been reinstated to the team, effective immediately. Most of Missoula was jubilant that he would be back on the field when the 2013 season commenced in September. In 2011, before he was suspended, Johnson threw for 2,400 yards and 21 touchdowns, ran for 506 yards and another 4 touchdowns, and led the Grizz to an 11-3 record. After an 18-month investigation, the NCAA forced the football team to vacate their final 5 wins of the 2011 season. As a consequence, the Grizzlies' official record has been revised from 11-3 to 6-3. But the sanction had nothing to do with the rape scandal. It was imposed for numerous violations of NCAA rules, the most serious of which was allowing 2 Grizz players, Trumaine Johnson and Gerald Kemp, to receive free legal representation when they were charged with obstructing a peace officer, disorderly conduct, and resisting arrest after police were called to break up a party at Johnson's apartment. A melee ensued, during which Johnson and Kemp were tased by the cops and thrown in jail. The lawyer who provided the free representation was Darla Keck, a shareholder in Milt Datsopoulos's law firm. In 2012, without Johnson, the team's record was 5-6, It was UM's first losing season since 1985. Although Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg didn't participate in the trial itself, he was in charge of the office responsible for prosecuting the case, and he observed the proceedings from the gallery on the final day. As the courtroom emptied on Friday afternoon, and David Paoli and Kirsten Pabst headed outside to take a victory lap in front of the television cameras that had been set up on the courthouse lawn, Gwen Florio, with notebook in hand, approached Van Valkenburg near the courtroom rail to ask what he thought of the verdict. "The outcome here is a not guilty verdict," Van Valkenburg grumbled. "It is not an innocent verdict." Florio included Van Valkenburg's comment in an article posted on the Missoulian website that evening. 3 weeks later, Pabst fired back at her former boss on her personal blog. "Van Valkenburg and his prosecutors," she wrote in a 2,400-word Jeremiah ad posted on Pabst's blog, "are bitter and have no respect for the jury's verdict. They will probably never admit that Jordan is innocent, that their decision to charge the case was premature and wrong." Pabst claimed in this blog that the Missoula County Attorney's Office decided to prosecute a case that lacked legal merit because of the intense pressure Van Valkenburg was under from Department of Justice investigators. He wanted to send a message that Missoula prosecutors had compassion for rape victims. "I would venture a guess that the next time the Missoula County Attorney's Office is called upon to decide whether questionable charges should be filed, the name Jordan Johnson will ring in their ears. I hope that prior to sending a message to the world, they will, at the very least, review the available evidence. That they will consider the permanent ramifications on all involved, that they will be cognizant of the personal and financial costs associated with the decision, and that they will remember that, on occasion, people are untruthful about abuse." As it turns out, insights about the verdict offered by Joanne Fargo, pseudonym, one of the seven women on the jury, suggest that Cecilia Washburn might indeed have been telling the truth about what Jordan Johnson did to her. "Ms. Washburn could have been raped," Fargo told me 19 months after the trial. "The evidence presented by the prosecution from the rape center Ms. Washburn went to for evaluation was convincing to me." Fargo said she found "Ms. Washburn completely credible. She seemed invested in her studies and focused on a career. I did not believe she manufactured her story of vengeance or malice of any kind. She seemed far too intelligent to have attempted to profit by false claims against Johnson." "From the testimony presented," Fargo reflected, "I got the impression Jordan Johnson pursued Cecilia Washburn. He had called her several times before she agreed for him to come to her residence. She hadn't prepared for the date. It seems like if she were going to snag the quarterback, she would have showered. If Johnson were anything other than a cad," Fargo added, "instead of forcing himself on Washburn, he would have saved himself for Kelly Froland, the woman he professed wanting to have a serious relationship with." Even though Fargo believed that Johnson might have raped Washburn, however, she also believed that the jury arrived at the correct verdict. "The defense raised reasonable doubts," she said, "about whether Mr. Johnson was aware the sex was nonconsensual, and the verdict was based wholly on the letter of the law as instructed by the judge. No one can really be sure Ms. Washburn made her intent clear to him." According to Fargo, it was hard for the jury to say in the moment whether Johnson took no as no. "He made a noticeable impression on all in the courtroom when he stated, 'She moaned,' while they were having intercourse, which the jury interpreted as a sign that Washburn was enjoying the sexual encounter." Asserting that an alleged rape victim was moaning seems to be an effective means of persuading police, prosecutors, judges, and/or jurors that the sex was consensual, rather than an act of rape, even though people moan in fear and pain as well as pleasure. But the moaning defense worked for Jordan Johnson. It worked for the four Grizz football players accused of raping Kelsey Belknap in 2010, and it worked for Jameis Winston, the Heisman Trophy-winning quarterback for Florida State University, when he was accused of raping a female student in December 2012. 2 years later, when Winston was asked during a student conduct hearing in what manner, verbally or physically, the female gave consent, he claimed she provided consent by moaning. Winston was cleared of misconduct. The moaning defense isn't always successful, however. When Caitlin Kelly accused UM student Calvin Smith of raping her in October 2011, Smith said part of the reason he believed Kelly consented to having sex was that she was moaning, but the university court found him guilty of rape regardless. Fargo said that testimony about the condom was also a key point in the decision-making process. Most of the jurors believed Johnson when he testified that Cecilia Washburn asked if he had a condom, Fargo explained. Washburn's testimony was ambiguous. The defense made a clear point of that fact. Johnson said he didn't have a condom. Her response was that was okay, which jurors understood to be an expression of consent on her part. There wasn't unanimous agreement about the verdict initially. When the first paper vote was taken in the jury room, Fargo told me, there were only 3 or 4 people who voted guilty. But after additional discussion and a second paper vote, 11 of the 12 jurors were convinced that Johnson should be acquitted. When the lone holdout for a guilty verdict was eventually swayed, according to Fargo, the handful of jurors questioning her were very respectful of her opinions. I was convinced she was comfortable with changing her vote through the thoughtful exchange of ideas. Even though Paoli and Pabst persuaded the jury to acquit Johnson, Fargo said, in no shape, way, manner, or form was I comfortable with Mr. Paoli's or Ms. Pabst's brand of practicing the law. I would characterize it as bullying. I found it beyond annoying, and I was frequently frustrated it was allowed, ad nauseam. The thing is, they occasionally made a point. It would have been better received without the theatrics. Joanne Fargo believed that Johnson probably benefited from the fact that several members of the jury were of a sufficiently advanced age to be mystified by the behavior of modern college students, for whom text messages are the default mode of communicating with one another. Texting was a foreign concept to some of her fellow jurors, Fargo observed. So the significance of the text Washburn sent to Stephen Green saying, OMG, I think I might have just gotten raped, might well have been lost on them. They were baffled about why she didn't scream out or run to her friend outside the bedroom instead of taking the time to type a message on her phone. Fargo, on the other hand, understood that texting was Ms. Washburn's usual form of communication. Texting what had happened to her made sense. Serving on the jury was an ordeal, Fargo emphasized. It was a very long, tedious, and emotion-driven trial that taught me a good deal about myself and others. More data received than I could ever envision. I would characterize the bulk of my experience as a nightmare I would not care to repeat. I had prepared myself for the long haul, but wasn't prepared for the toll it would take on me emotionally, and eventually, physically. Media coverage of the trial went nationwide, she said, and people I didn't know suddenly knew me. The courtroom was filled every single day. It was a suffocating crush at times, and certainly toward the end. I felt like I had a target painted on me, Fargo told me. People would constantly come up to me and start a conversation. I know you're unable to discuss the trial, but... and then give their opinions. Without exception, everyone leaned toward Jordan Johnson's innocence. Ms. Washburn was always spoken of in the negative. In fact, I was astounded by the ignorance of acquaintance rape. A very old concept of rape prevails. According to this mindset, there can only be 2 precursors to rape. Number 1, a stranger jumps out from the bushes. Number 2, there is no rape unless the woman puts up a fight, to the death if necessary. Part 6. Aftershocks. On the playing field, every single mistake a player makes is pointed out and criticized until corrected. By design, on the field of real life, the athlete rarely faces similar accountability. Sadly, and too often with tragic repercussions, athletes don't distinguish right from wrong because they actually have no idea of what is right and what is wrong. Rules don't apply. Acceptable standards of behavior don't apply. Little infractions become bigger ones, and adults turn a blind eye. If someone gets into trouble, the first move is for an authority figure, usually in the form of a coach, to get them out of it. When that doesn't work, whether they're high school quarterbacks or pro ball pitchers, one of 2 things happens. Sometimes, especially at the high school level, the community rallies around the accused, wanting to believe that boys will be boys. We don't want to admit, but in all these stories, it's not about the individual or the individual sport, but about the culture we have allowed to grow around them. It is in vogue now to blame and condemn athletes. They should be held accountable for their behavior, but we are just as culpable, allowing them to exist in a realm all their own and not caring a bit about what we have turned them into, as long as they bring us victory. Buzz Bissinger, The Boys in the Clubhouse. New York Times, October 18, 2014. Chapter 29. Just before the Jordan Johnson trial began, the New York Times published an article in which Montana Regent Pat Williams said, "We've had sex assaults, vandalism, beatings by football players. The university has recruited thugs for its football team, and this thuggery has got to stop." Williams was widely denounced for these remarks by Grizz fans, who circulated a petition demanding that he be removed from the Board of Regents. On March 10, 2013, 9 days after Johnson was acquitted, Williams published a guest column in the Missoulian to address the ongoing criticism and to try to save his job. He wrote, "We Montanans have always preferred straight talk from those who represent us. My choice of words with the reporter was candid, chosen to illuminate my concern with the actions of outlier convicted student-athletes whose behavior have damaged public and personal safety as well as scarred our university. For 50 years, I have worked to improve and enhance educational opportunities for young people across our state and throughout the nation. As a teacher and a member of the Board of Regents, I will continue to defend our efforts to educate the next generation and form leaders of conscience. If I turned a blind eye to violence in our university communities, it would impede these goals." A week later, David Paoli responded to Williams with a Missoulian guest column of his own. It made Paoli look like a sore winner. "Pat Williams is a friend of mine, so he will understand my advice." Williams abused his position as a regent to ignorantly blast University of Montana student-athletes. When he was roundly criticized for his bombastic statements, he wrote a guest opinion to explain himself. "Pat, when you are explaining, you're losing." More than his offensive language, the timing of Williams's ambush is more concerning. His quotes ran on February 6th in a New York Times story regarding a highly publicized trial set to begin 2 days later. His "thugs and thuggery" quotes were printed two paragraphs above a discussion of whether the falsely accused could receive a fair trial amid such controversy. Montanans expect honest, reasoned judgment and respect from their representatives. Montanans do not expect cheap quotes to the New York Times to develop more frenzy and throw kerosene on an already blazing situation. Williams is not a racist. However, his use of the racial epitaphs "thugs" and "thuggery" are racist. Anyone who has lived in D.C. or Seattle or Berkeley or anywhere else knows very clearly that the use of these words have serious and hurtful racial overtones. The use of these racial slurs requires an apology. 5 days after Paoli's piece ran, the Missoulian published a rejoinder from former Montana Supreme Court Justice Terry Treweiler, one of the most esteemed lawyers in the state. "Missoula lawyer David Paoli is a friend of mine, so I'm certain he won't be offended by my opinion of what he characterized as advice to Pat Williams. Let me preface my remarks by pointing out that I've been a college football fan all of my life. Football paid for my college education. And I've been a season ticket holder to Grizzlies football for many years. Still, I've been mystified by the reaction of many Grizzlies football fans to Williams's remarks describing too many of the team's players as thugs and his commitment as a regent to end the thuggery." Paoli lambasted Williams's remarks as ignorant, abusive of his position as a regent, and unfair to Paoli's client. He threw in a little race baiting for good measure, even though the term used by Williams is racially neutral, and the offenders he referred to were both black and white. It seems to me, on the other hand, that anyone who doesn't recognize the problems Williams described wouldn't be fit to serve as a regent, and that the real ignorance is demonstrated by attacking the messenger for his unpleasant message. It might be helpful to review the conduct over the past 5 years that he accurately categorized as thuggery. It includes a fatal shooting by Jimmy Wilson, and his teammate Quentin Freeman's refusal to participate in the investigation, even though he witnessed it, following which Wilson was found not guilty and they were welcomed back to the team. Freeman's numerous convictions for acts of violence and ultimate dismissal from the team. Freeman's armed burglary with the assistance of several other players. The brutal assaults on another student on campus by two other players. Tremaine Johnson's and Andrew Swink's violent assault on another student. Johnson's and Gerald Kemp's obstruction of a peace officer, Bo Donaldson's rape of a female companion, several players' alleged involvement in a gang rape, the University of Montana president's admission following an independent investigation that a number of players had been involved in sexual assaults, and the recent brutal beating and robbery of a convenience store clerk by a former player with a history of other violent and illegal conduct. Throw in several other violent assaults on women by some of these same players. During the same period of time, 7 players have been arrested for driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs, a couple of them repeat offenders. As a result of this history, the university is being investigated by the NCAA, the Justice Department, and the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights. If people who kill others, rape others, beat others, and burglarize and rob others aren't thugs, then what are they? And how much thuggery does it take before a member of the Board of Regents is free to say we need to do something about it? While it is true that Paoli's client was recently acquitted of the charges against him, Paoli takes himself and the acquittal too seriously when he infers that the acquittal of one player vindicates the entire program or makes Williams's comments any less true. As alarming as this 5-year pattern of conduct should be, the greater long-term problem will come from the culture of entitlement that causes players here and elsewhere to think they are unaccountable for their conduct because of their athletic ability, and the knee-jerk reaction of program supporters, including Paoli, to anyone who questions where and how things might have gone wrong. There's no one in the state more qualified to serve on the Board of Regents than Pat Williams. He has spent a lifetime in service to public education and was defending the Constitution, including the rights of the accused, at some political cost, long before most of his detractors took any interest in the criminal justice system. To think his appointment could be derailed over comments that were both honest and long overdue, though, would suggest one miscalculation on Pat Williams's part: his belief that most Montanans appreciate straight talk. In 2012, Governor Brian Schweitzer nominated Williams to the Montana Board of Regents of Higher Education, to a term due to expire in 2019, but the nomination required confirmation by the state Senate. On March 20, 2013, the Montana Senate Education Committee held a confirmation hearing on Williams's nomination, and most of the hearing was spent debating Williams's comments to the Times. Jim Foley, who had been forced to resign as UM's vice president for external relations after playing a controversial role in the university's rape scandal, and had served as Williams's staff director when Williams was a U.S. congressman, argued against Williams's confirmation. His former boss's published statements, Foley fulminated, were callous and injurious, both to the citizens of this state and to the thousands of UM student-athletes and UM alumni around this country. Enough is enough with this name-calling against young men who in most cases can't defend themselves against words. On April 4th, the Montana Senate voted on Pat Williams's confirmation. The tally was 26-23 to reject his nomination, and he was ousted from the Board of Regents. 10 days after the Jordan Johnson trial ended, Allison Hugot was at her father's house in Missoula, watching the 5 o'clock news, when she learned from a report broadcast by the local NBC affiliate that Bo Donaldson had asked the Sentence Review Division of the Montana Supreme Court to reconsider the sentence he'd received for raping her. Hugot was astounded. To avoid a jury trial and a possible sentence of up to 100 years in prison, in September 2012, Donaldson had signed a plea deal with the state of Montana, in which she agreed to plead guilty to raping Hugot in return for a guarantee that he would be sentenced to no more than 10 years at the state prison. The deal also included a condition that unambiguously stated, "By signing below and accepting the benefit of this agreement, the defendant expressly waives any right to appeal. Defendant further waives any right to make application for sentence review." The state had held up its end of the bargain on January 11, 2013, when Judge Karen Townsend sentenced Bo Donaldson to 10 years at the state prison. Yet Donaldson was now trying to rescind his promise not to appeal his sentence to the Supreme Court. The Sentence Review Division, consisting of 3 judges, nevertheless agreed to hold a hearing to reconsider Donaldson's sentence. These judges could decide to reduce his sentence, but they could also decide to increase it, so requesting the review was not without risk. Milt Datsopoulos, Donaldson's lawyer, said Donaldson was willing to take that risk because "we felt so strongly that the sentence was clearly excessive." The hearing to review the sentence was held on May 2, 2013, in a small room inside the Montana State Prison at Deer Lodge, where Bo Donaldson was incarcerated. Milt Detsopoulos addressed the court first. He felt the sentence was excessive because of Judge Townsend's failure to provide the option of a sentence to the Department of Corrections rather than a sentence directly to the Montana State Prison. Detsopoulos argued that the sentence imposed hadn't been balanced with the need to rehabilitate Donaldson to help prevent him from becoming a recidivist. Unlike a lot of star athletes, Detsopoulos told the court, Donaldson was a good student. He was a person of value, substance, ability, and was no threat to the community. Were it not for alcohol, he insisted, this young man wouldn't be in prison. His whole life is almost pristine. Incarcerating Donaldson in the state prison wasn't necessary, Detsopoulos maintained, saying that it was avoidable by letting him serve his time at the Department of Corrections instead. Following Detsopoulos, Bo Donaldson told the court, I do take responsibility for the actions that I've done and the hurt that I've caused, and I just feel that if I can get the opportunity to be sentenced to the Department of Corrections, I can not only rehabilitate myself, but make myself a better person. Donaldson's mother, Kathy, testified that Bo has always been a good person. He was raised that way. Yes, he does need to be punished, but he also needs a chance. He was just shy of 21 years old when he made a very, very bad decision. When my son puts his mind to something, he will do it. His goal is to have a life. My goal for him is finish his college education, find happiness, get married, have children, be a wonderful father. I am not as young as I would like to be, but I would like to be able to be alive to see that. I plead and pray that you have read and looked at everything, and you have open eyes and an open heart, because there's a plate missing at my dinner table, and I want it back. Kathy Donaldson told the three judges that Bo's sentence is our sentence. I'm selfish. I want to see him in a program where he can get the help that he needs. I don't want to see him sitting in a cell and not getting the opportunity that he deserves. Larry Donaldson, Bo's father, asserted to the court that Bo is the only person that's been totally honest from day one. He's never varied from the truth. When Bo called Larry from jail to say he'd been arrested, Larry said, He told me, If I did something wrong, Dad, I need to take responsibility. He's a big part of a lot of people's lives. Just give him a chance. I love you, Bo. When it was her turn to testify, Allison Hugot began by explaining that she came today not because I want to be here at all. Then she turned toward Bo Donaldson and, choking up with emotion, said, Listening to your mom breaks my heart. Immediately thereafter, her voice hardened, however, and she told the judges that Larry Donaldson's claim that Bo is the only one that's been honest was not only untrue, but a complete slap in the face. After Bo Donaldson's arrest, Hugot pointed out, he lied to numerous people, saying that she had consented to have sex with him on the night he'd raped her, and falsely claiming that she'd had consensual sex with him on other occasions before the night he raped her. Hugot was infuriated by Milt Detsopoulos' statement that requiring Bo to serve his sentence in the state prison was avoidable. She said, Well, raping me was also avoidable, and it's a choice he made. She observed that Donaldson could have requested a trial, but chose to make a plea deal instead. I cannot understand why Bo even has the right to ask for a review of his sentence, she said, after he'd explicitly agreed to waive that right in the plea deal. Detsopoulos, Hugot reminded the court, claimed Bo's life had been pristine because his criminal record listed no serious prior offenses. However, she said, if you looked at all the facts in this case, you will see that Bo absolutely has a lot of past criminal behavior. She noted that Donaldson had admitted to underage drinking, lying to the police, illegally obtaining and using Adderall, painkillers, and cocaine, and disorderly conduct charges that had landed him in jail the weekend before he was arrested for raping her. Moreover, Donaldson had sexually assaulted Hillary McLaughlin. While Bo may not have been charged for these acts, some of which are felonies, Hugot continued, it does not take away from the fact that these crimes had very serious effects on others. It is clear that Bo has gotten away with a lot during his short 23 years of life, and it worries me that if this sentence is reduced, he will once again be sent the message that his actions are acceptable. Miltatsopoulos, she said, brought up Donaldson's age and potential as a reason why sentencing him to the state prison was excessive. The only potential Huguette saw in Beau Donaldson, she noted, was the potential for hurting a lot of females. Being a young and charming football player, Beau had, and I'm sure still would have, a very large victim pool. Allison Huguette said, "As we grow up, we are taught to stay away from strangers and creepy people in the alleyways, and not to go anywhere without someone you trust. But what happens when it's the person you trust who rapes you? I'm tired of living in this hell." Her family had been forced to suffer the hell of the rape's aftermath, too, she explained. "My mother, specifically, is not here today because she, emotionally, can't handle any more of it. She can't even look at me without having flashbacks of picking me up in the middle of the road that night. Or hear my voice without being reminded of my screams for help, or telling her that Beau had just raped me and was chasing me down an alleyway. If Beau Donaldson was truly remorseful and understood the pain and damage he has caused," Allison Huguette said, "he would know he deserves the sentence he's been given, and then some. He would take responsibility for his actions all of the time, and not just while trying to get his sentence reduced. He would not allow his friends and family to blame me or slander my character for what he has done," she continued. "I'm deeply frustrated by the fact that he thinks he deserves this sentence review. I don't get to go to a review board and ask them to reduce the pain I feel daily, or take away the flashbacks, nightmares, or anxiety, or restore my sense of safety and security, or my trust in people. I don't get to ask them to give me back my innocence or joy, or the life that he has sucked right out of me. And somehow he thinks he's the one that's being punished too harshly." Weeping, Huguette told the judges, "The night that Beau chose to wait until I was alone, asleep, and defenseless, walk over to me, pull down my pants, pull down my underwear, pull down his pants, pull out his dick, and shove it into me, he gave me a life sentence. A life in which I have to work every day to get through the pain. Some days I have to convince myself it is even worth it. I don't get to go to a review board and ask them to reduce the life sentence he has forced on me. There is a reason why people say that rape is the worst crime a person can survive." Allison Huguette said she wanted Beau Donaldson to get help and treatment, but at the end of the day, he has to be punished, and the only thing that is excessive in this case is the amount of suffering that Beau has caused. When Huguette finished, Hillary McLaughlin addressed the sentence review division via a video feed from Great Falls. "To hear that Beau Donaldson wants a lighter sentence for sexually assaulting a stranger and raping a lifelong friend is extremely hard for me to understand," she told the judges, and then she described Donaldson's attempt to rape her in 2008. Afterward, McLaughlin explained, "instead of reporting it to the police, she tried to put the incident in the back of my mind and just forget about it, without success. Due to Beau Donaldson," she said, "I have lost my sense of comfort with nearly every person I meet. I have lost who I was before I met him. I live in constant fear of being attacked at any moment. I am constantly looking over my shoulder. I had never experienced anxiety, but now I am treated daily for it. I get nervous, anxious, and scared at any given moment. I struggle with being alone in my own home. And as a 23-year-old woman, I am afraid of the dark. I wake up with nightmares of being attacked, and I'm up for hours on end because I can't get these visions out of my head. Even while I was screaming and telling him to get off me, he continued to try and sexually assault me. I am stuck living and remembering this feeling for the rest of my life. I am stuck with fear, anger, hurt, nervousness, and anxiety." Like Allison Huguette, Hillary McLaughlin was appalled that Donaldson was claiming that his sentence was unfairly harsh. "I think he got off easy," McLaughlin declared to the court, "and I hope by telling my story you realize that his maximum sentence of 10 years is temporary, but mine is forever." Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg had accompanied Huguette to Deer Lodge, and after McLaughlin completed her testimony, he addressed the panel of judges. "I'd like to begin," he said, "by telling you a couple of things about the two witnesses you've just heard from. When Missoula police and prosecutors first learned that Donaldson had assaulted Hillary McLaughlin, Van Valkenburg explained she was initially very reluctant to get involved in the prosecution. But she came to understand that silence was essentially acting as approval for Beau Donaldson's actions. And although it was difficult and unpleasant to testify at his sentencing hearing, she felt it was a duty on her part to try and protect future victims. As for Allison Huguet, Van Valkenburgh said, the morning after Donaldson raped Huguet, she told him she would not report him to the police if he would seek counseling, treatment for his drug and alcohol abuse, and sex offender treatment. During the 14 months following the rape, however, it became increasingly clear to Allison that Beau had no real intention of keeping those promises to her. Instead, Donaldson continued to drink, to take drugs, to party, to laugh in her face when he saw her. Around this same time, Van Valkenburgh told the court, the Missoulian published several articles quoting anonymous women who said they had been raped by football players from the University of Montana. Allison began to think, my God, Beau Donaldson is out there raping other women because I failed to report the case involving him, Van Valkenburgh explained. So she went to the police and reported that he'd raped her, resulting in his arrest. Subsequently, Donaldson entered into a formal plea agreement with the state, and the agreement had a provision that said, the defendant expressly waives any right to appeal or ask to have his sentence reviewed. Yet, Van Valkenburgh lamented, here he is at sentence review. The court should take that into consideration. The sentence Donaldson received is reasonable under the circumstances, Van Valkenburgh observed, and Judge Townsend thought long and hard before imposing it. The state, Van Valkenburgh pointed out, had a strong case against Beau Donaldson because of his tape-recorded confession. There wasn't really much reason for us to negotiate with the defense at all. But we did, because to some degree, any time you go to a jury trial, it's a roll of the dice. It took a long time for Van Valkenburgh's office to convince Allison Huguet to support the plea deal proposed by the state, because she thought 30 years in prison with 20 suspended was too light a sentence, he said. But one of the things we told her was that if this sentence is imposed, it won't get set aside later on an appeal or by a sentence review panel. Beau Donaldson has essentially put himself in the situation that he's in right now, Fred Van Valkenburgh said. But he's done more than that. He's given a horrible black eye to something that is a source of tremendous pride to the people of Montana, the University of Montana football program, and the University of Montana in general. Enrollment is way down. The university has a budget shortfall of $16 million this year. That's going to affect every student at the University of Montana. And Donaldson, he asserted, is one of the people principally responsible for that. Judge Townsend is a thoughtful, reasoned jurist, Van Valkenburgh continued. She imposed a reasonable sentence on this defendant, and I would respectfully ask you to uphold this sentence. Van Valkenburgh paused for a moment, then added, and I will tell you, it's a little tempting to ask for a slightly stiffer sentence, but I won't. I will just ask that you uphold the sentence that Judge Townsend imposed. Thank you. At this point, one of the three judges scolded Milt Datsopoulos for promising that if the sentence imposed by Judge Townsend fell within the parameters of the plea agreement, as it in fact did, he would not put the victim through any further proceedings, appeals, sentence review, or otherwise. So, this judge demanded, how did Datsopoulos explain his request for a sentence review? Datsopoulos answered that he felt Beau Donaldson deserved a new sentence because the plea agreement was coercive. This was a preposterous assertion. Nobody had forced Beau Donaldson to take a plea deal. Nothing had prevented him from going to trial and having his future decided by a jury of his peers. In Missoula, Grizzly football exists in a realm apart, where there is a pervasive sense of entitlement. University of Montana fans, coaches, players, and their lawyers expect and often receive special dispensation. Datsopoulos had built a thriving law practice in this environment, and he appeared to believe that his client's pledge not to appeal his sentence wasn't meant to be taken seriously. Because Beau Donaldson was on the football team, the promise shouldn't apply. None of the three judges appointed to the sentence review division by the Montana Supreme Court was from Missoula, however. When it became clear to Datsopoulos that they weren't impressed by his claim that Donaldson had been coerced into making a plea deal, he tried a final, desperate maneuver. He attempted to convince the judges that Donaldson deserved a lighter sentence because when he'd confessed to raping Huguet at the time of his arrest, he'd knowingly done so without a lawyer present, thereby eliminating the potential for Datsopoulos to mount an effective defense. This voluntary confession, Datsopoulos argued, proved that Bo Donaldson accepted responsibility for his crime and wanted to make things right. Maybe. But on the day Donaldson was arrested, when he went to the police station and gave his statement to Detective Guy Baker, Baker had just informed Donaldson that he'd secretly recorded Donaldson's phone confession to Huguette, so Donaldson was already aware that the police knew the truth. The judges weren't swayed by any of Datsopoulos's arguments, and they upheld the sentence imposed by Judge Townsend, 30 years in the Montana State Prison, with 20 years suspended. Donaldson would be eligible for parole in July 2015. It's both instructive and disturbing to think about how Huguette's case might have turned out differently if Detective Guy Baker hadn't obtained a confession from Donaldson. Without a recorded admission of guilt, Chief Deputy Missoula County Attorney Kirsten Pabst might have determined that there was insufficient probable cause to charge Donaldson with rape and declined to prosecute him, just as she declined to prosecute Calvin Smith for raping Caitlin Kelly, and as Fred Van Valkenburgh himself had declined to prosecute the football players accused of raping Kelsey Belknap. And even if Bo Donaldson had been charged, it would have been a much more challenging case to prosecute without a confession. Milt Datsopoulos might have refused to accept a plea deal, sending the case to trial, whereupon Donaldson would have testified that the sex was consensual, and Datsopoulos would have elicited testimony from Donaldson's friends corroborating this claim. At which point Datsopoulos would have launched a ferocious attack on Huguette's character. It's not hard to imagine a jury being persuaded that there was reasonable doubt about whether Huguette had consented to have sex that night. In that eventuality, Donaldson would have been found not guilty, just as Jordan Johnson was found not guilty, and Donaldson would now be a free man, unrehabilitated and unregistered as a sex offender, able to rape again. Huguette received plenty of reminders that many people continued to believe that she'd falsely accused Donaldson of rape and that he was innocent, even people she had thought were her friends. 2 days after Donaldson's sentence review hearing, one such person, a young woman who had grown up with Donaldson and Huguette in Missoula's Target Range neighborhood, posted a hateful message to Huguette on Facebook. "Do you not understand you are messing with someone else's life? Not just for a short moment, but for the rest of their lives? Suck it up and own up to your own damn mistakes. Act your age. We are not in middle school anymore where things are brushed off. This is real life. Karma is a nasty bitch, and I cannot wait until she comes back to bite you in the ass." Chapter 30. Back in May 2012, when the U.S. Department of Justice had announced that it was investigating the Missoula County Attorney's Office, the Missoula Police Department, and the University of Montana for their unsatisfactory response to sexual assault complaints over the previous 3 years, the police and the university agreed to cooperate fully with the investigations. Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburgh, however, declared that the MCAO would not cooperate with the DOJ, and he defiantly refused to give federal investigators access to prosecutors in his office or their case files. A year later, shortly after the Jordan Johnson trial, the DOJ completed its investigations of the Missoula Police and the University of Montana, and announced that it had reached formal agreements with both institutions to overhaul the way they handled sexual assault cases. The DOJ reported that its agreement with UM was a blueprint that can serve as a model for campuses across the nation. And some months thereafter, an independent auditor reported that the Missoula Police Department was making steady progress in complying with the changes decreed by the DOJ as well. Fred Van Valkenburgh, meanwhile, remained adamant in his refusal to work in concert with the DOJ, claiming it had no legal authority to investigate the MCAO. Permitting the feds to interview Missoula prosecutors and examine their case files would set a dangerous precedent, he claimed, which would allow the heavy hand of government to meddle in the affairs of thousands of district attorneys nationwide. In an attempt to persuade Van Valkenburgh to abandon his obstinacy and start cooperating with the Justice Department, in December 2013, Michael Cotter, U.S. Attorney for the District of Montana, sent Van Valkenburgh a proposed agreement between the DOJ and the MCAO that would improve the safety and security of sexual assault victims in Missoula. It would compel the MCAO to hire in-house investigators, instead of relying solely on the police department to investigate sexual assault cases, hire in-house victim advocates, and establish a designated sexual assault unit, It would also oblige MCAO prosecutors to meet face-to-face with every victim who reported a sexual assault, and it would require supervisors to review every case declined for prosecution to ensure that the decision hadn't been inappropriately influenced by a failure to understand the dynamics of non-stranger sexual assault. Michael Cotter's effort to end the DOJ's 20-month standoff with the MCAO had the opposite of its intended effect, however. Van Valkenburgh interpreted Cotter's proposal as a thinly veiled threat to sue the MCAO if Van Valkenburgh didn't agree to the DOJ's demands, and Van Valkenburgh took umbrage. He responded by essentially telling the DOJ to kiss his ass. Fred Van Valkenburgh asked the Missoula Board of County Commissioners for $50,000 to fund a lawsuit challenging the DOJ's right to tell his office what to do. In making his pitch to the commissioners, Van Valkenburgh argued that by suing the DOJ, he could make an important statement about barring the federal government from intruding into local legal matters, while simultaneously saving Missoula taxpayers as much as $400,000 over 2 years. His estimate of how much it would cost the county to pay the salaries of the new personnel the MCAO would be forced to hire if it acquiesced to the DOJ's demands. On January 9, 2014, after the commissioners pledged to fund a lawsuit, Van Valkenburgh sent U.S. Attorney Michael Cotter a 6-page letter reiterating his refusal to comply with the dictates of the Department of Justice, which, he said, would force the Missoula County Attorney's Office to unnecessarily spend hundreds of thousands of taxpayer dollars to do what it already does. Instead, Van Valkenburgh offered an alternative proposal. If the DOJ would get off his back, the MCAO would make a commitment to assist the Missoula Police Department and the University of Montana Office of Public Safety as they fulfilled their respective agreements with the DOJ. Fred Van Valkenburgh was happy to help city and university cops submit to the lash of the DOJ, in other words, but it would be a cold day in hell before the Missoula County Attorney's Office would let itself be tyrannized by the federal government. Furthermore, Van Valkenburgh threatened, if the DOJ failed to affirmatively indicate in the next 2 weeks that it was willing to accept his alternative proposal, he was prepared to take any action necessary to prevent the DOJ from imposing its will on his office. Given Van Valkenburgh's famously stubborn disposition, few Missoulians were surprised by his desire to kick sand in the face of the DOJ, but some prominent citizens thought suing the federal government was a horrible idea. On January 15, 2014, the Missoulian published an open letter to the county commissioners from a respected clinical psychologist, Francis Marks Buck, who'd provided therapy to numerous local crime victims. Under the headline, Van Valkenburgh's Ego-Based Fight Affects Communities' Well-Being, Buck wrote, "In Montana, unlike some states, the state attorney general has no jurisdiction or oversight of county district attorneys. The only oversight is the electorate. There are clear problems in the functioning of the Missoula District Attorney Office, both with the district attorney himself and a number of assistant district attorneys. In my opinion, Fred Van Valkenburgh's stance of non-cooperation with the DOJ is ego-based, not principle-based. He is focused on the right of the DOJ to investigate, not how he, his assistant district attorneys, and the community could benefit from the recommended changes." Van Valkenburgh was unmoved by Buck's letter. On February 11th, when the feds hadn't budged from their position, Van Valkenburgh filed a lawsuit against the Department of Justice, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, and U.S. Attorney Michael Cotter, seeking a judgment declaring that the defendants do not have the authority to investigate or sue the Missoula County Attorney or his office. Van Valkenburgh based his legal claim on the federal common law doctrine of absolute prosecutorial immunity, which serves the same purpose that underlies the immunity of judges and grand jurors, namely to protect the judicial process. The DOJ responded to the lawsuit 72 hours later, on Valentine's Day, by releasing a 20-page report, personally addressed to Fred Van Valkenburgh, that documented the failings of the Missoula County Attorney's Office in blistering detail, based on a far-reaching investigation that included interviews with former MCAO prosecutor Kirsten Pabst, former Missoula Police Chief Mark Muir, 9 Missoula detectives and police officers, and more than 30 female victims of sexual assault. When the DOJ had announced its investigation in May 2012, it had noted that at least 80 alleged rapes had been reported in Missoula over the preceding 3 years. But the findings sent to Van Valkenburgh in February 2014 revealed that there were actually 350 sexual assaults reported to the Missoula police between January 2008 and May 2012, a span of 52 months. As part of its investigation, the DOJ asked an eminent supervisor of a police sexual assault unit and an eminent sex crimes prosecutor to review these cases. According to the DOJ, Valentine's